How are we doing today? Good. I'm so glad to see you all. Because I don't know about you, but I could use a little good news. Sometimes it seems like the only kind of news we get these days is bad news. So this morning, we are here to talk about good news. So happy Resurrection Sunday. And today we celebrate the tomb is empty, and there's new life. There's this new world bursting forth all around us. And so today, we celebrate that, and we remember that first resurrection morning so many years ago. Now, today, what I want to do is I want to tell you a couple of stories. And so I have an outline, and so if anyone's taking notes, here's your outline. So there's this phrase ahead of you that Mark tells us in his Gospels. And so for the past couple of weeks, I have been asking myself, what in the world does this phrase possibly mean? And I thought, well, the more I thought about this, it was like, oh, well, the only way that we can talk about this phrase ahead of you is talk about midnight drives in the Bronx and high school soccer. You tracking so far? Yeah. So this is where we're going. We're going to talk about this phrase, and then midnight drives in the Bronx, and then high school soccer, and then we're going to celebrate Eucharist together. Are we good? And then we'll go eat turkey or lamb, whatever your choices. So let's start here in Mark chapter 16, verse 1. Now, this would have been the earliest gospel account of the resurrection. And it begins, "When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Now, very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, 'Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?'" Just a very practical question. Who's going to roll the stone away so that we can go and anoint the body? "But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed." Now, whenever there's a character, someone in the Bible who doesn't have a name, I like to give them a name. So we'll call this young man Seamus. Good Irish name, is it not? So there's a young man named Seamus who's here at the tomb, and he says to them, "Don't be alarmed, for you are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb, and they said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. So we have this phrase here, ahead of you. Jesus is going ahead of you into Galilee. What could possibly be the significance of this? Maybe another way of saying ahead of you is saying Jesus is going before you into Galilee. But what's the meaning of this? Now, we have a map here I want to show you. And what we see towards the bottom is Jerusalem is down there in the south. Now, Jerusalem is where Jesus was crucified. This is where all the dreams of the disciples came crashing down. All their hopes, everything that they had put their faith in for the past 3 years, all of a sudden came crashing down in front of them here in Jerusalem. Now, the women go to this tomb, and the young man here tells them, go into Galilee. We notice Galilee is up here in the north. It probably would have been about a six-day journey. Maybe if you're taking a whole bunch of pit stops or you've got a whole bunch of selfies you're taking, it might take about 2 weeks. So either way, we're looking at a week, maybe a little bit more of a journey. And what we know from some of the other gospel accounts is that the disciples had not begun the journey back to Galilee yet. I mean, of course, if the women are still at the tomb, well, they're still out there in Jerusalem. And one of the other gospels actually tells us that the disciples are huddled in the corner of a locked room. So in other words, the disciples have not made the journey home yet, because Galilee is home. Galilee is where Jesus did the bulk of his ministry. Galilee is where the disciples hail from. It's where they were raised. It's where they live their lives. So maybe for the disciples, they were hanging out in Jerusalem. They were staying there because the pain of going back home to those old familiar places, of all the streets and restaurants and lakes and homes where they used to hang out, maybe that pain was just too raw. Have you ever lost someone? In the beginning, it was just a little too difficult to go into their room or to go back to a restaurant where you have so many fond memories. Yeah, for the disciples, they were staying in Jerusalem because the thought of going back to Galilee, where they had spent all this time with Jesus, good memories, it was just too difficult. And here are the disciples. They had been all in on Jesus. They were following. They believed. They had allowed their lives to be disrupted. They had lost friends. They had sacrificed time with their family. They sacrificed essentially their entire lives to follow Jesus. Here they were. They were going to go make Israel great again. And then all of a sudden, crucifixion. And Jesus, their leader, the one that they had followed, that they were going to follow until the end, was lying in a tomb. So it's at this point in the story where they're thinking, we backed the wrong horse. We were all in on red and it came up black. And they were thinking, was Jesus, is he really the person that he portrayed himself to be? They're beginning to think, have we just lost it all? Was the last 3 years a complete waste of our lives? Have you ever been there where you believed? You followed, you were all in. The outcomes, they were certain. You knew exactly how it was going to turn out. And then all of a sudden, that was all violently ripped away from you. And you're left there, alone, directionless, leaderless, confused with all sorts of questions swirling around inside your mind. This is where the disciples are. Now, when I was 19 years old, I had a friend of mine, and he asked me, he said, hey, I need to go pick up a car of mine at my dad's house in Long Island. Now, we're not talking Long Island right across the bridge. We're talking Long Island, like Siberia, Long Island. All the way out at the end of the island. And I believe I was in college, and it was during the summer. And this was my friend, but it was also my boss, and it was one of my band members. Lots of different relationships here. Now, Friday night, he says, we're going to go, and we're going to go and get this car. So we hop into my car after work on a Friday. Now, I don't know if you've ever driven to Long Island on a Friday night in the summer. Not a good idea. So think about it. We've worked the entire week. Now here we are driving to the far end of Long Island. We're leaving at about 6 o'clock at night. I don't remember exactly what time we got there, but I do know that we were eating hot dogs in 7-Eleven at like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. So we get there, we get the car, and it's so late, we're like, all right, we're just going to drive back. Now, I'm 19 years old. I do not own a cell phone, because this was before cell phones. So I don't have GPS. I have never driven to Long Island before. I have no idea where I'm going. Getting there, he told me, make this turn, go here, do this, get on this road. Going back, I'm like, all right, I don't know where I'm going. He's like, don't worry. It's going to be fine. Just follow me. Now, side note, this friend of mine was also a youth leader when I was growing up at church. And we went to a concert one time. We got home over an hour late from this concert because this leader, driver, drove in circles for over an hour. And I remember sitting in the van and someone pointed out, hey, haven't we passed that gas station for like the fourth time? And his driving was so erratic that one of my friends actually at a red light decided that she was going to get out of the van because there was another car that was following us. She says, I can't stay in the car anymore. I'm going to throw up. Let me run around to this other car. So she begins to get out of the van, has one foot on the ground, on the road, one foot in the van. The light turns green. He takes off, totally unaware that there is someone half in the car, half out. This is the person that I am following home from Long Island. When I told this story to one of my friends who knows who this person is, his only response was, dear God. So we start making the trek back from Long Island to Westchester. Everything is good. LIE, clear sailing. We get across the bridge and I lose him. No idea where he is. I don't know where I'm going. I end up on some back, deserted, dark street in the Bronx in the middle of the night. I finally find a gas station, which is the only beacon of light on this entire street, and I pull into this gas station, and there's a crowd of a few people who are over here on the side that when they see me driving in, they look up, and it's almost like they began to wonder, who is this white dude in this little blue Subaru station wagon? Listening to Green Day, probably, coming to this gas station at this time of night, because nothing good happens at a gas station past like 8 o'clock at night. So I pull in, I park the car, and I see where the cashier is. I get out of the car. I decide to lock the car because it just seems like the natural thing to do in this gas station at this time of night, even though I'm only walking like 10 feet away. I walk up to the cashier, who is behind a bulletproof window, which makes me feel extremely comfortable, of course. Start asking for directions. Now, I do not think those directions helped me at all because I remember continuing to drive around for a very, very long time before I finally found a road that I recognized the name of. And as I was aimlessly driving around in the Bronx in the middle of the night, I had all these feelings start. Oh, I can't believe my friend just left me. He wasn't paying better attention to me following him. And I started to get really angry and upset, like, oh, I was mad at myself. Like, why did I say yes to this? I knew this was going to be a bad, yeah, just trust me, just follow me. I know how you lead people, especially when you drive. And here I was, 19, without a phone, with no idea where I was, completely lost, scared, just wanting to get home. Wishing I was back home safe in my bed, wishing all of this was a dream, and that I could be back in Westchester where I belonged. See, that this is how the disciples would have been feeling at this point, directionless, confused, wishing for simpler times, wishing that they were safe. Wishing that they didn't have to hide out in fear, thinking if this group of people were to find us, would we suffer the same fate as Jesus? Would we go to our death as well? They're huddled in a room. They probably have all sorts of questions and doubts and resentments building up, swirling up within them because Jesus had said, follow me, and they had. And this is where it all ended. This is what following Jesus brought them. Now, before Jesus had been crucified, he actually told the disciples the very same thing. And if we go back a couple of chapters to Mark chapter 14, he's having a conversation. And he says, you, I believe this is verse 27, you will all fall away, Jesus told them. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. But after I have risen, I will go ahead of you into Galilee." And Peter declared, "Even if all fall away, I will not." Famous last words. "Truly, I tell you," Jesus answered, "today, yes, tonight, before the rooster crows twice, you yourself will disown me three times." But Peter, "Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you." And the rooster crows three times. And all the others said the same. See, so Jesus had already told them, "Hey, just so you know, I'm going to die, but meet me in Galilee. Bob's Burgers, you know the place to get milkshakes after casting demons out? Yeah, that's the spot. Yeah, we're going to meet there." So, but you have to excuse the disciples if they don't really believe Jesus, because if someone like your neighbor Sally were to tell you, "Hey, I'm going to die on Friday, meet me in Vegas on Sunday," you're not going home and booking plane tickets that afternoon. You're probably, "All right, I'll see you." Because I don't know about you, but what I've noticed in life is that dead people normally stay dead. Just an observation. And so for the disciples, when they hear, "Hey, meet me in Galilee," they're not thinking this is real. They're not getting their hopes up. They're not rushing home to Galilee as quickly as possible. When I was a freshman in high school, I broke my leg. And it was during a soccer tournament. And, oh, goodness. So it was pouring rain, and the people who had put this tournament on, they didn't want to actually mess the schedule up at all. And so we were playing on one of the backfields, and they did not want to bring an ambulance all the way across all these other fields in order to come to me where I was laying there with a broken leg, because like, we're going to disrupt the schedule too much. So we had to have, they put me in a lawn chair. And there were two people who were carrying the back of me, and I think there were three people carrying my leg so it didn't just drop. And these three people were trying to prop my leg up so it didn't move around too much, and they had to carry me in the rain, through the mud, all the way across these four fields to where my dad decided to bring his car up, which was a two-door Pontiac Grand Am. And they decided to jam me into this two-door Pontiac Grand Am, which seems weird now, but I guess apparently at that time seemed like a great idea. And when they couldn't get the seat down enough to lay me into the back, someone finally decided to call an ambulance to put me in. And I get to the hospital. They cast me. I'm in this long leg cast for the entire summer. Coat hangers, the whole thing. I finally get out of the cast, I rehab, and I get to play soccer again. Now, I had convinced myself when I was starting to play soccer again that I really wasn't scared, and that what had just happened to me was a fluke, and that everything was okay, and I wouldn't break my leg again. But the truth is, as I got back into playing soccer, I noticed that I was pretty apathetic about the whole thing. And it's really hard to be apathetic about a sport when you are the goalie. Like, if you're a forward, or you can, like, run around and be like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that defender," or, "Oh, I missed the ball," or just, like, pass it off as quickly as possible. But if you're the goalie, you can't be like, "Oh, I missed that one again, sorry, guys." Just doesn't work. Pretty soon, everyone, all the fans and all the players, all my teammates are going to notice, "Hey, Dave, you might want to step it up a little bit." And one of the other things I realized is that in this time when I came back to playing soccer, I acted almost as if I was above the sport, as if I had evolved to some higher level and I was better than all these other minions who are kicking a ball around inside of some white lines. How primal of a thing is that? This was my attitude towards soccer as soon as I got back into it. But then, during one practice, someone kicked the ball from one side of the field all the way into the goalie box in the air. And so I half-heartedly jumped up to go grab this ball, and this dude came rushing in and knocked me flat on the ground. So I was sitting there on the ground, everything boiling, like, who is this guy? What does he think he's doing? And all of a sudden, I started feeling within me, I will never let that happen again. If another ball comes in the air in my box and another defender and a forward comes in, he is going to be the one on the ground eating the dirt the next time. not me. And it was at that point when my passion for soccer, the fire that I once had, started coming back to me. Because the very thing that I didn't want to have happen happened. And I realized, I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm here. And I didn't break my leg again. I didn't get injured. And in fact, playing scared would most likely only cause a greater injury. Not giving myself fully to this game would probably cause an injury in itself. See, it's easy to play scared in life. All you have to do is tally up a list of all the times that you've been burned, the times that you've gotten stabbed in the back, the times that it blew up in your face, and the times that you were left in the Bronx in the middle of the night with no idea of where you're going. It's easy to play it safe, keeping yourself at arm's distance from anything that could possibly hurt you, so that you will never have to feel the pain of what you experienced ever again. This is where we find the disciples. They're huddled in a room, hiding out in Jerusalem, keeping themselves at a distance from anything, any hope that could ruin them. Why? Because what if they were to go back to Galilee and Jesus wasn't there? What if they were to go back to Galilee, this place where Jesus had promised them, I'm going to meet you here, where this young man at the tomb tells them, go, Jesus is there. What if they were to get there and Jesus was nowhere to be found? Maybe they're thinking, we can't go there quite yet, because if we got there and he's not there, I don't know if we could ever recover from that. Well, we're better off staying here, picking up some of the pieces, putting some of the things back together again before we go to Galilee, just to get our lives disrupted one more time. How much of our lives do we spend playing it safe in Jerusalem? Sure, it comes across as wisdom. The fact that we've evolved. I've been there before. I've seen it all. I've experienced it all before. There's nothing new to see or experience here. I've done it all. I don't need to go and do this. I don't need to go here. I've already been there before. But see, this is the wisdom that is disguising a past hurt. This is a wisdom that's disguising pain, a past pain that we've experienced. And if we just keep ourselves far enough away, if we just show the rest, everyone else, hey, we've evolved beyond that, then we never have to put ourselves in a position where we can be hurt again. It's safer here on the couch with a remote and a tub of ice cream. We're just like the disciples. How much of our lives do we spend on the bench in Jerusalem? But yet Galilee, home, risking again, getting up and moving, this is exactly where Jesus is inviting the disciples to go. This invitation that Jesus gives, it's an invitation to see that the interruptions in life, and yes, there are many interruptions, painful interruptions, they are an opportunity to see the new life, the new possibilities that are bursting forth all around you. See, for me, getting knocked on the ground, it was the very thing that I needed in order to get myself back in the game. It's the thing that I didn't want to have happen, and yet it did, and I realized, I feel good. There's still life in me. I still have more to give. There's still a truer, deeper self of who I am that I can discover. There's still more to experience. There's still more life all around me. See, this is why Jesus invites the disciples back to Galilee. As they pick themselves back up, they risk again. They're able to see the resurrection life, the new hope, the new possibilities that the Spirit is bringing forth all around them. The Spirit is inviting them to experience and to be a part of. So what I want to do here as we close this morning is I want to celebrate Eucharist together. This good gift of Christ that's given for the healing, for the restoring, the putting back together of you, of me, of this creation. And the invitation that Christ gives is an endless invitation. And it's to believe that your sin, your shame, your failure, your pain, your disappointment is not the final word. It's an invitation to trust that tragedy and death are not the end of the story. But the Spirit of God is alive in you, bringing forth hope. The Spirit of God is alive in the world, bringing forth new opportunities, new ways of seeing this new creation that God is birthing around us. And so this morning, I want to invite you to come forward, and as you take the bread and dip it into the cup, may you receive the grace, the healing, the love, the new life that you had believed was too good to be true. God, we thank you that the tomb is empty. God, we thank you that we can come here this morning and celebrate resurrection. God, the resurrection of our lives, the resurrection of creation. And God, for many of us, God, we've had experiences in life that have been painful, gut-wrenching. God, experiences that have knocked us on the ground. And we're left wondering, why go on? Why get up from this? I'm just going to get hurt again. And so, God, for many of us here, we've been in Jerusalem playing it safe on the bench. And so today, God, I ask that your Spirit would breathe life, new life into us. God, if that's us sitting on the sidelines, I pray that you would give us a new vision of the life that you are calling us into. God, as we come forward this morning, as we celebrate Eucharist together, God, may we feel your grace. May we feel your healing, your love upon us. God, may we see this new creation life that we have in Jesus. And so I pray that today would be a new beginning, a new start. God, that the fire, the passion that's been buried within us would rise again. So we ask all this in the strong, resurrected name of Jesus. Amen.